A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Today's podcast is sponsored by FastBitcoins.com. FastBitcoins provides a simple way for people to buy Bitcoin directly from their bank account or with cash in physical stores. Their services are rapidly growing in availability across the UK, Estonia, as well as Canada, and they're launching in Australia soon too. FastBitcoins is committed to providing high-quality Bitcoin-only services. They want to make sure that the growing number of people interested in buying and benefiting from the possibilities of Bitcoin can do so easily, securely, and with as few distractions as possible. Learn more about FastBitcoin's range of services at fastbitcoins.com, including how you can earn Bitcoin for free through their referral scheme. That is fastbitcoins.com. FastBitcoins.com, go check them out.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, I'm going to be speaking to James Wythe, who is a UK-based food blogger and also a health coach as well. So welcome to the show, James. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me on the show, Zuby.
That's my pleasure, man. So we're going to be, you've got a really interesting story. We met a few months ago, actually, in Bournemouth. Funnily enough, I think it was at a cryptocurrency related event, wasn't it?
So, yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah, and then we both found out that, you know, we're both do our own thing online with me and my music and my podcast and you and your food blogging and everything. So yeah, I feel like this is long overdue. So I've given a very short summary of who you are there, but why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, we met at that crypto event and I think we just bonded straight away just from actually having a social media type following, which can obviously be an interesting space on its own. So I run a food blog called Healthy Living James. I specialize in gluten, dairy, egg and refined sugar-free recipes, but not just that, mainly just focused on sort of healthy recipes that trying to inspire people to cook from home, essentially. And I started that about 3.5 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And how did you get into this space? I mean, you told me about it when we first met, but you've got a really interesting story that led you into this. So we can talk a little bit more about the sort of direct work you do and the food blog and everything like that. But I'm interested in the journey of how you came to this position.
Yeah, sure. So when I was, if we go way back, I was a good golfer. So I studied, focused on golf for when I was, so I started when I was 10, focused on that and become quite good at it by the age of 14 or so. I started playing for Dorset and Dorset Juniors team, Dorset men's team, and then built up to where I was playing for Bournemouth University. And it was my whole focus was golf. I wanted to be a professional golfer. So my whole life was sort of driven towards that goal. Mm-hmm. Very goal-driven person. So that was something I really wanted to achieve. And suddenly at the age of 21, I woke up one morning and wasn't feeling very well. I was sick for 2 weeks straight and it was felt like food poisoning. So okay. I spoke to the doctor. They said that it's classic food poisoning symptoms and that I would get better. If anything, I got worse. I wasn't being sick anymore, but I was, the energy levels had just plummeted. I just was feeling shocking. So I waited probably a month or 6 weeks and then just wasn't improving. So I felt like something wasn't right. But I just kept pushing and pushing myself. I went on holiday with my parents and came back and I suddenly crashed badly. I wasn't able to talk. I couldn't stand up. I wasn't eating. Yeah, I was in a very bad way. So my dad had to physically carry me to the doctors. And I remember the doctor speaking to me saying, you know, what are your symptoms? And all I could say was ambulance. I had nothing in me apart from that word. Wow. So they rushed me in for a suspected brain tumor. Obviously, it was a super scary time from someone that was so fit and healthy and could do pretty much everything to being in that situation. So I was rushed in, kept in for 2 weeks and had every test you could imagine. Everything came back clear. Like, it was kind of a relief that I didn't have those things, but then I was still left in the open with no answers.
Yeah.
They said that it was probably a virus and that I needed to just go home and rest. Mm-hmm. So it kind of was like a good answer, but not in a way. It was strange. It was a strange feeling. So I went home and rested. And nothing really changed. If anything, I just deteriorated for the next few months. I was in a dark room, couldn't even have the blinds open, couldn't watch TV, wasn't able to text or even hold a conversation.
Wow.
So I was in a very dark place for probably 3 months of that, where I was like that.
And this just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, completely out of nowhere. And like I said, from someone that was so active and could play 36 holes of golf in a day, which is a good 10-mile walk, you know, that's pretty shocking place to be in. So I then was, say, 3 months, and then I was slowly starting to like be able to tolerate a few things a little bit better. Like, I was able to tolerate light a little bit better. I could actually eat again, and slowly sort of improved a little bit that way. But at the 6 month mark, that's when I had a nutritionist come to visit me.
Okay.
I was diagnosed with ME, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome. ME stands for myalgic encephalomyelitis.
Okay.
Which is a lot of people would have heard of it, but it's a very misunderstood illness. I think years back it was called yuppie flu.
Yuppie flu.
Yeah, years back. I don't know how long ago that was, but it was a long time ago.
Okay.
So it's always had sort of a bad stigma around it, I'd say, and very they will only diagnose you with ME after 6 months, or that was the case back when I was ill. This was 9 years ago now.
Okay.
So I was diagnosed with that and told that I basically just, there was no cure. There's no cure to it. Like, there's no tablets or anything like that that can cure you. It's they basically say to you that, you know, you're on your own and you've got a, they have no answers for it, essentially.
That's crazy. I mean, what's the cause of it? Is it viral? Is it hereditary? Or?
They don't really know. This is the thing. They don't know what it's caused by, how to, you know, get better. I think the problem is that a lot of people that suffer with it are completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it's kind of a blanket term that is used for symptoms that the doctors don't understand. So I think there's an underlying cause that's different for a lot of people, but they don't know what it is.
Okay.
So for me, I was, the nutritionist that came to visit me said that you need to try cutting out gluten and dairy and see how changing your diet, taking a few supplements, whether that can help you.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that religiously. My mum was my carer for the 2 years that I ended up being bedbound for.
Wow.
So she would cook all my meals for me. And we were always very health conscious anyway. We weren't, you know, eating tons of takeaways or anything like that. Always fairly a health conscious family.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a huge change for my mum cooking wise, maybe a few adjustments here and there. at the start. And we started to notice that I was improving, not quickly, but bit by bit, to the point where I could then get out of bed and walk to the window that was, you know, a few meters away.
Mm.
Then that would burn me out for a few days, and then I would do it again to the window. So, and I, you know, slowly built up to the point where then I could go down the stairs, but I'd have to lay down on the sofa for a few hours before I could make it back up the stairs.
Yeah.
So it was a very gradual process. And from someone that, like I said about golf, that had this mentality of push, push, push nonstop, like trying to be better and always perform better, that was a really hard thing to take mentally.
Yeah.
That was probably the biggest thing that I've learned out of the whole process now, is how mentally strong I'd say I am now from this whole process.
Yeah. I mean, you must be. I mean, what was going through your mind during that time? I mean, that's so you were stuck in bed essentially for 2 years early 20s. I mean,
yeah,
that's crazy. I mean, as someone who's very active myself, who loves exercise and training and stuff, I mean, I struggle to even fathom what that would be like. I mean, as we are recording this, you know, we're in the midst of this coronavirus pandemic. Some people have been stuck in the house for maybe 5 days to, you know, 5 to 10 days. And, you know, myself included, I'm already like, okay, I want to go to the gym. I want to, you know, go and do this and that. People are already, you know, sort of losing their minds a little bit. And I can't even fathom for 2 years sort of being bedbound, especially not even knowing what the reason is either.
Yes. It's when I think back, because obviously it was 7 or so years ago. Well, it started 9 years ago. So I feel like a lot of it I've kind of like put in the back of my mind and don't think about too much.
Yeah.
But kind of when I've listened to a lot of sort of people moaning about the situation we're in right now and the being locked up, it kind of, it's different obviously, because now I'm in this situation where I'm being, you know, isolated, but I feel much, much better.
Yeah.
So it's different. Like when you're ill and confined, you kind of don't have a choice. But I think when you're healthy and fit and full of energy, it's even worse in a way being locked up, because you can't, you want to go out, but whereas if you're ill, you can't. Like, yeah, do you know what I mean? It's a different mindset.
Sure.
But during that time, it was incredibly tough from the point that you said, where I didn't know what was going on. No one could give me answers. The only answer I was getting from doctors was, you're on your own. Like, you know, you're going to have to find your own way through this. I had no support there at all, apart from obviously family around me.
I just think it's nuts. It's so weird to hear of any condition where, I mean, even with most stuff, the doctors don't really know all of the ins and outs of, you know, they normally at least know, they normally know something, you know, there's normally some sort of answer or recommendation or something. It just sounds so weird to me for them to just be like, well, sorry, man, like we don't know. Good luck. Like,
and that was essentially what it was. So I skipped past one of the points where I was actually rushed back into hospital again during that. Probably about the year mark of being bedbound, because it got to a point where the doctors said, do you think you're depressed? And I was like, well, never suffered with depression before I was ill. And I was kind of like, you know, laughing in a way, because I was like, well, you know, if you've been in bed for a year, you'd probably be a little bit depressed too, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, anyone would be, but it's not the cause of me being there. You know, I'm not laying here because I'm depressed. I'm depressed because I'm here.
Yes.
Like, so it was tricky, because I was so desperate. Like, I just, all I wanted to do was get out and play golf again, like, you know, be normal again. And so he said, do you want to try taking antidepressants?
Okay. Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, I'll give it a go, feeling that, you know, it might make me feel better or might be a miracle cure I didn't know. So I tried them, they put me straight in hospital. I had severe allergic reaction.
Oh no.
Yeah. I was rushed into hospital. it felt like my whole body was going to explode. Like I was literally felt like my veins were going to pop, like they were on fire. It was a horrific experience.
So
I was rushed in, and the doctors even said to me there, you know, are you hearing voices? And I was like, come on, guys. You know, I know they need to ask these certain questions, but I just felt so crap. Like I felt so ill.
Yeah.
And you're asking me that type of question. I'm like, well, no, I'm just, I need help. Yeah. You know, I just, someone help me. I'm not very well and I need to get back to where I was.
Yeah.
And I think past that point, I lost a lot of trust in the medical sector for my condition.
Yeah. So
I kind of just went at it on my own. I think I've been back to the doctors twice since that day, only for, you know, if I've been had a cough and need to just get things checked up, but I stay away really. And I think, yeah, with what's going on right now, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So the isolation part now is kind of tricky because I do play golf again now, and it's a different mindset. But I don't find it particularly hard, you know.
Yeah, well, you've had some unfortunate but probably valuable mental and physical training.
Yeah, and like you were saying before this, we were saying that we both work from home. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of doesn't necessarily feel that different to us, even though the whole, there's an aura, isn't there, around right now that's just weird.
Yeah.
Because this has never happened. So, but I'm not finding it particularly hard right now.
So talk us through a little bit more. So we started to talk about the changes in your diet. So you said you cut out gluten and you cut out dairy.
Yeah.
And what was the result of that?
So it wasn't a quick change, like a quick improvement. It was, you know, over a few months, because the progress that I had was so slow, it was really hard to, you know, pinpoint exactly what was helping me. But if you do have, you know, a damaged gut and these issues, it can take 5 years to actually heal it. So, I would say 6 months, it felt like it started to really make a difference. So we're talking now up to the year point where I then had that allergic reaction was put back in. Okay. So, and then through the next year, it was all focused around nutrition, taking a few supplements, cutting out gluten and dairy, just eating home cooked, you know, my mum's cooked food.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very focused around nutrition for me in that the next year, from me making it from that allergic reaction to the 2 year point where I then made it, I would then call myself housebound more than bedbound.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And so, I mean, how did you know that it was the gluten and the dairy that sort of made the difference?
It was only one of two things I was doing. So okay. It was cutting out the gluten and dairy and eating, you know, more home cooked food.
Okay.
And then also the a few supplements that I was taking as well. Mm-hmm. I think probably overall three things really helped me. I had Bowen therapy, which is a type of massage that I was having. That's spelled Bowen.
Okay.
You can find practitioners across the UK for that. So I was having that, the gluten and dairy, cutting out the gluten and dairy, and also a few supplements that I was taking. I think all three of those came together to really make me stronger and help me recover.
Gotcha. So in the work you do now, you primarily focus around foods that are free of gluten and free of dairy. So look, most people don't have a dairy intolerance or allergy, nor one for gluten. So what is it about those two? Well, one of them is more of a food group. One of them is more, what would you even call gluten? Gluten is technically it's like a starch really, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a gluey sort of ingredient.
Yeah. What is it about those two things that you think, or that you know, both for yourself and sort of for some other people as well out there, for some percentage of the population, those things seem to cause an issue. I'm just trying to understand the link between the condition that you had and those two food items, if you see what
yeah.
I mean. There's nothing obvious that's like, oh yeah, cut out dairy or cut out gluten and that will help. You see what I mean?
I think they're generally considered as like inflammatory for your gut. So because no one really understands what's going on in the sort of ME situation for each individual, I think it was from the nutritionist side, it was a case of the gut has a big role in, you know, your overall health for everybody. So I think trying to strengthen the gut side was probably her first instinct, was to try and see if things like that made a difference. So I know gluten and dairy are very inflammatory for people's guts. So if you do have any type of like IBS or leaky gut or stuff like that, they're the common things to try and cut out to see if you improve. And like I said earlier, it can take years and years and years of gut healing to be able to eat those again. So,
okay. So we've talked about the sad part and the somewhat depressing part of the story.
Yeah. But
anyone who has seen your work now or who follows you on Instagram or any other social media will know that actually your work is very much, is very bright and colorful and tasty and delicious looking. In fact, I haven't tried any of the food, but you know, I follow you on Instagram. So I see some of the pictures popping up. If I go to your page, it's all, you know, colorful and looks very appetizing and everything. So tell us a little bit more about how you got into the world of food blogging and doing what you do now.
It's been a crazy journey. Like you said, yeah, it's full of colorful food now. So once I've made it past that bedbound stage, I was then in the housebound stage, and me and my girlfriend then, who's now my wife, we decided to get a flat together in Bournemouth. So we moved in, and she was obviously out working to support both of us. So I had a lot of free time now, and my mum was cooking for me before, so I had to then start cooking for myself. So I kind of like didn't have a choice at the start, like it was something I had to do to survive. And then I discovered that I actually quite enjoyed it more and more, and it became my passion and like something I look forward to each day because it was the only thing I really was doing. So it gave me a focus and something to take my mind off of what situation I was in. So I'd have a chair in my kitchen that I'd pull up and cook and sit down on, because I didn't still have the energy to stand up for probably more than 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay.
So my focus became, okay, well, I need to cook gluten and dairy free, healthy home cooked food with little energy. So I then taught myself how to cook those type of recipes from a chair. So it then developed into a real passion of mine. I built up sort of a library of recipes and learned completely self-taught how to cook. I don't really think I'd cooked before I was ill properly, you know?
Okay. Like, so how did you do it? Was it just trial and error? Were there certain people you were following online, or was it just throwing things together?
Pretty much just chucking things together and seeing what happened. Because back then there wasn't really anyone doing, you know, gluten and dairy free meals. Like this, we're talking 7 years ago.
Okay, true.
You know, nowadays it's a crowded space, but back then there wasn't really anything going on. So I had to figure that out myself. And then it came to a point where friends and family said that I needed to share the journey, which scared me because I'd never done anything like that before.
Sure.
So having to put my life from being so confined and like hidden behind the scenes to then put myself in front of people again was weird, like a pretty scary thought. But I just thought, you know, let's give it a go.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Awesome, man. So how did you begin to document it, and what platform did you document on? Was that on Instagram? Was it YouTube? How did you go about doing it, or a blog?
Yeah. So I started a WordPress blog. Okay. I decided when I was going to do it, it was, early 2016, mm-hmm. Probably the first few months, maybe February 2016. So I said to myself, right, I'm going to create the recipes that I'd said that I'd sort of bundled together. But at this point, I was only probably 50% recovered as well. So it was taking me quite a long time to, you know, put this content together. I'd never taken a proper photo before in my life. So it was trying to do all of that. Took me time. So it probably took me 6 months to get about 20 recipes onto the blog.
Okay.
And I started social media platforms at the time that I launched the blog, which was August 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it out to the world and focused mainly on Instagram and Facebook.
What made you pick those two platforms?
I think Instagram was because it's so visual.
Okay.
And Facebook probably because it was still the most popular back then.
Mm-hmm. It still is, to be honest, actually.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah. Still is actually by quite a long shot. But it's weird. It's like, it's still the most popular, but it's not like the most trendy. But in terms of numbers, in terms of users, it's still, over 2 billion. And there's nothing close to that. Yeah.
I noticed a difference in age groups between the two. Yes. I get interaction is quite different now.
Mm.
So those are the two that I focused on. I mainly focused on Instagram out of both of those. Like that was the place where I felt most comfortable. Like it was somewhere that it wasn't so much about the words.
Yes.
And hence why I don't really use Twitter. Like I know you focus heavily on Twitter.
Sort of beast. Yeah.
Words aren't my strength.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
I use the image to portray what I'm doing type thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's Twitter was one of those that I have, but it's always been a trickier place for me, my type of content.
Of course. I tell with every creator, it depends on what you do and it depends on your own style of communication. I mean, I'm a rapper, I'm a podcaster, yeah. I'm a public speaker. So everything I do is word based, and the way I think and the way I can see it, like it's all very, you know, I can do visuals, I can do video, but my natural inclination is towards words. So I kind of use all the others. You know, I do use Instagram, I do use Facebook and YouTube, but Twitter is sort of I feel like Twitter was sort of made for me, if you know what I mean.
Like
in the way
exactly.
I feel Instagram was made for you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that your content comes across the best in the space that you feel most comfortable as well.
Yeah. And you'll enjoy
it. Feels, yeah. Yeah. And it's social media is all about once you build a following, like we both have done now, like it becomes a place that still has to be enjoyable for you, because if you're not enjoying it, it's useless. Like it's just not a good place to be. So it's still got to be very enjoyable for both of us in the area that you're focused on.
And how did you go about building up your following? I mean, I know on Instagram now, you've now got well over 70,000 followers on there. And of course, a lot of work and time goes into that. So how did you, in the initial stages, how did you start to build an audience around what you were doing?
I've always just turned up every single day. You know, I might have a few days break here and there, but I've always showed up every day. I think that's the thing that people don't take into consideration when they start. You have to be consistent, like turning up daily. Plus the algorithms on Instagram were a lot more friendly back 3 years ago than they are now.
That's true.
And I've noticed that when I had, say, 5 or 10,000 followers, which I built fairly quickly. I'd say the first 5,000 I built quite quickly. Don't know how, I just sort of turned up. And I think being a new person on the scene in a heavily female dominated market, being a young guy. Yeah. So my market, the type of food that I create is so, I mean, I've never found a guy like me. I still haven't. I've not found a guy that creates recipes or content like me.
Yeah.
In the food space.
Okay, that's interesting.
So I think that kind of hit the mark as well, being quite unique in that aspect. So I just turned up every day, built that 5,000 followers, and I felt like now I'd say I average, say, anywhere between 1,000 to 1,500 likes on a photo. Mm-hmm. And I would say I was getting that when I had 10,000.
Yeah, it's weird like that. It's weird. Both with Facebook and Instagram, which are obviously both owned by Facebook, their algorithms over time have become... Yeah, it's part of actually why I also like Twitter, is because Twitter is still shifty with the algorithm. And I don't know, I mean, I got temporarily suspended last month for
something. I saw that.
So, unfortunately, I don't feel like I can't really totally put my trust in any of these platforms now, because they've all just done too many things over the years that I think are sort of morally dubious and questionable and very subjective. But, you know, hey, it's where people are. It's what we use. So, you know, you've kind of got to take the best.
Scary that the amount of power that's there, because I've taken 3.5 years to build that type of following on Instagram, and it could be gone tomorrow.
Dude, it's hard to migrate people. You know, it is hard to migrate people. It's something I think a lot about. I mean, on my Twitter, I mean, when I got suspended, I had 210,000 followers.
Yeah.
You know, that's like more than the population of Bournemouth. It's like, I don't...
It's crazy.
I've got some of those people on other places and some on my mailing list and stuff, but I don't have all of them. And I mean, I've been on social media a long time. I used to use MySpace back in the day. And I remember I built my MySpace up to like 30,000 people. And that was before MySpace sort of like died. So that was like for me, that was like an early lesson of, oh, wow, you know, you can put all this focus on one platform and build it up. And then something can happen in a year. Suddenly you can no longer reach all these people, but there's still no, you know, I'm sure you have an email list and some other things, but it's difficult because there's no sort of perfect, I haven't yet worked out sort of like the ideal way to get people off of those things and onto other things. Like, I'm always trying different things, but it's tricky.
Yeah, it's very tricky to, because obviously people tend to gravitate to their main social platform, don't they? So to try and get someone off of that platform. So like, obviously stories now have the swipe ups, or have done for a while now. And you really have to hit the nail on the head with the content to get people off of stories. So, you know, when you're scrolling through stories, you're like clicking, skipping, whatever. So for someone to actually engage and swipe up is quite a hard thing to get. Because it's kind of like a game now, isn't it? It's like skipping through stories, or just taking in the information that you want and skipping past the rest. So it is tricky. Like, I do have an email list as well, and I think I start over the last year, I've really started to focus on the blog side and making that the best place, and also driving a lot of traffic from Google, trying to improve Google and trying to drive a lot of traffic from Google to the blog as well, which wasn't happening at the start. Like, that was all my traffic to the website was all from socials, nothing from Google. Whereas now I'd say half, maybe 60% of my traffic to the site is Google.
That's good, man.
Which is awesome. Yeah.
No, that's awesome, man. And you now, I mean, you now do the food blogging full time, don't you? You now make a living totally off of that.
Yeah.
So how long have you done that for? And how did you go about doing that? Because there are going to be so many people listening to this who, you know, maybe not in the food blogging world or in the podcasting world, but, you know, something, right? A lot of people have different interests and things they want to build businesses out of, and hobbies that they maybe like to earn an income from. So I think a lot of people out there are curious as to, how does one go about becoming a full-time food blogger? You know, how did you do that?
Yeah, it's crazy. Even when I think now, I sit here, I'm like, it's just weird, like how this has all happened. So it all starts from it being a passion. Mm-hmm. So it has to be a passion for you. You have to enjoy turning up every day and doing the same thing. So I'd say that's a key point. And one of the things that I did, so although I started 3.5 years ago, it took me, I was getting brand collaborations coming through Instagram and stuff, because I still was growing a following. So I was getting interaction from brands, but I decided that I would pick and choose a couple just to sort of learn how the process worked, more than actually doing it for the money. Okay. And I learned a little bit about how that relationship works with the brand. I would turn like 99% down for the first, say, 2 years. And it was about a year and a half ago, just over a year ago, when I decided, right, now's my time to, I've held off waiting for the bigger stuff. Mm-hmm. And now's my time to sort of, you know, really start turning it into a business as such. So I started focusing around then approaching the bigger brands that I wanted to, you know, having that being held off and not doing the smaller stuff, I felt like really helped me as well. Mm. But obviously not everyone has that choice.
How do you choose what kind of brands to approach? Because in the world of food blogging, to me, it doesn't seem obvious sort of what those partnerships and collaborations would be. So is this with, I don't know what sort of companies did you approach? How did you go about mapping
that out? It's a lot of it just comes, I tend to work, well, only work with brands that I use products wise already. Sure. So if a brand approaches me that I don't know of, or, you know, not really used, I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's quite easy because you just look in your cupboard and be like, mm-hmm. right, there's that peanut butter. I want to work with them.
Okay.
And so you just hit them up.
So like almost like ingredient companies or like specific product companies of things that you use in your recipes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I work with brands like can create a recipe using their product. Mm,
okay.
And it might not be sound actually like a lot of potential ones there, but it's actually a lot bigger than you think, the amount of products there are.
Yeah. It's just interesting because I'm always interested when I speak to people who do things that are, because it's very niche, isn't it? Mm. It's not just niche in the term, in the sense that it's a food blogging, but, you know, gluten-free, dairy-free, you know, primarily a plant-based food blogging. It's like, that's like a niche of a niche of a niche.
Yeah.
So it's always interesting to me when I meet people who in any sector do something that just makes me go like, oh, wow. Okay. That's not something I'd kind of thought that you can kind of do. So
yeah. Cool. Yeah. I haven't really thought of it that way, that it is a niche of a niche in a way. Yeah. Mm. I think it's because I've built up to a point where probably the second biggest gluten-free blogger in the UK, maybe across Europe as well, like that. When it comes to a guy aspect, biggest by far, because I don't actually know anyone else.
Yeah.
So I think that's really helped being different. Mm-hmm. I think that's really helped me be a different voice in a heavily crowded market from a female voice.
And how do you connect with the audience directly? Given your work is, you know, it's food based, it's recipes, it's you know, if someone goes on the Instagram, they'll see pictures of the food, occasional picture of you, but, you know, it's primarily about the food. So given that, how do you connect with people on a sort of human level? Or is that not super duper important in the food world? Or if it is, how do you do it rather than it just being about the food and about the pictures?
Yeah, good question. I think at the start I originally didn't want to put myself in front of the camera at all. Like I was so like, I just wanted to hide away and just hide behind my phone, put Instagram photos out cooking food. And then I started to realize that actually people aren't necessarily just coming for my recipes. They're coming because they, you know, follow the journey and trust in me and want to get to know me as a person. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned that mainly because of following other people. And I was like, well, I connect with certain people via listening to them talk on stories, for example.
Sure.
And you feel like you start to know someone, don't you? So I think I really focused on when stories came out. I even remember when stories came out. It's probably 2.5 years ago, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And I was petrified of being on camera. Like I'd never put I think I'd Instagram for maybe a year without even putting myself video on camera.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, because stories was the first real point about having a chance to do that, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. There was no other way of really doing that. And now stories are so normal, but back then that was a really like crazy thing to come out. So I would do stand there and do like 50 takes of me filming myself doing a recipe. And then it just got like silly because I was just standing there like selfie doing 50 takes. I'm burning stuff behind me.
Oh, no.
And then, you know, just like, I just wanted to give up. I just kept doing it, kept practicing and just really understood how people connected with listening to the real parts behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So now I just do, I don't need to do any takes. Like it's just come, I mean, I might do it if I say something stupid or irrelevant, but I kind of like just do it straight off now.
Okay.
And I think that comes across and people really connect to seeing the authentic, like true you behind the food. I think that's really helped with my recipes doing really well now.
That's cool, man. And where's your audience mainly based? Is it primarily?
Instagram.
Okay, no, I meant geographically.
Oh, right. UK, London, okay. UK based, heavily okay, cool. UK based.
Okay.
And it's the 25 to 35 range on Instagram. Mm. And heavily
mostly
female
women?
As well.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
I think 90% wow. Instagram female, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's, I think my podcast and YouTube are like 90% male, actually. Maybe the podcast is like 80-20, but yeah. With me, it varies a lot platform to platform. Like my YouTube audience is like very, very male dominated. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, more of a mix. All of them male dominated, but maybe like 60-40-ish.
Yeah.
But I think definitely the food world. I think that there are just certain sectors where it's like, all right, that's you're gonna get male dominant there. You're gonna get female dominant there, and you know,
I think especially from the sort of like niching down into a niche area, like you said, I'm not vegan, but a lot of my recipes are vegan or plant based.
Yeah.
I do eat fish occasionally, but I have a dairy. I don't eat dairy, can't eat eggs.
Yeah.
So like I kind of just exclude, I don't eat meat either. I stopped about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. So I think the space that I'm in is heavily female dominated anyway.
Yeah. I think in the world of food, to have a male dominated audience, you'd need to just do like sort of carnivore based barbecued,
gym based.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like throwing meat on a grill. I think even like normal gym based stuff, you'd probably still get a female leaning just because. Yeah, I think if you want for a male focus, it would have to be like really sort of like obvious, just like manly, like throw some elk on the grill kind of thing, you know, Joe Rogan style,
real macho.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's cool, man. So, what are your aspirations with it all now? I mean, where do you see this going? Have you ever done any live events, or are you thinking about it? Where do you plan to go with it all?
So that was another thing. I just put off doing cooking demos and things like that, public speaking, because it was literally like my number one fear.
Mm.
I think that maybe.
Do you know what that's called?
No.
It's called normal. It's called glossophobia, and it's actually the most common fear.
Is it?
Yeah, it's the most common phobia. It's called glossophobia, which is the fear of public speaking. So, just a random fact there. In fact, more people when surveyed are afraid of public speaking than of death. So yeah, just rant. I don't know how they surveyed that, but I just thought it was an interesting fact to throw out there.
I mean, I totally was one of those.
Okay.
I think a lot of it came from being so confined for like so many years. I wasn't socially interacting with people, and then to stand up and do a cooking demo in front of 100 people.
Yeah.
Sounded like a horrific experience. Like it wasn't something. And I was turning them down for probably a few years in that time, just because I didn't feel ready to put myself under that stress.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think part of the tough thing is to actually say yes. Once you say yes, and you feel like you're committed into doing something,
mm-hmm.
I was ready to kind of just get stuck in and do it. I did have a bit of hypnotherapy help me sort of navigate through the fear a bit better. And understand that it, you know, it's not why maybe those issues have come up for me in the past, you know, bullying and all that type of stuff, that a lot of it stems from something that's happened to you in the past. So I dealt with a few of those things, and I got to the point where I just felt like it was my time to give it a go.
Okay.
So I did one probably just over a year ago now. Jumped in front of 100 people, went great. And I still get extremely nervous. I think I've done 6 now, and I still get really, really nervous doing them because I'm not an extrovert. Like, I'm
okay. Yeah.
I'm well and truly an introvert. Like, okay. There's no doubt about that.
That makes sense.
So I think putting myself out there has been tough for me. But I'm getting better at it, and I do enjoy it afterwards. The high that you get afterwards is incredible. Like, once you overcome a fear, it's the best feeling ever.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And it's interesting because I'm really interested in personality in general. I'm someone who's a natural, much more of a natural extrovert.
Yep.
And so it's just interesting how, you know, different personality traits have, you know, both there. So for someone like me, I mean, I don't know. I think you can be an extrovert, but learn to almost like embrace some, I don't want to say like, I think I'm an extrovert who's not like, I think some people could almost imagine that I'm an introvert. Does that make sense? Just like, yeah. I think there are people who are natural introverts, but if you sort of saw them on camera or met them in public or something, you'd get the feeling that they're like a natural extrovert. So yeah. I'm kind of cool being like home alone for a day and just kind of doing my stuff on my computer or whatever. But I do find if I do that for like 2 days running or something, I do get this like, okay, I just need to like go out and be amongst other human beings.
I get
wound up like more quickly in that sense. But then on the plus side, it means, you know, I've got no fear of talking to strangers. I can run around and talk to thousands of people and have done. And I'm fine with that. I'm cool with that. I can jump on a stage and rap for people or talk or, you know, whatever. And I'm cool, fine in that sense. So it's everything's just a balance. You know, everything's
like you said, it's a public speaking is a big issue for a lot of people. And I think it is getting over that first hurdle. Like people kept saying to me, oh, you need to just chuck yourself in and do it. And I was like, well, I think that's good, but I also think you need to be ready mentally to do it. So I don't think, like, say public speaking is your biggest fear in the whole world, going and standing in front of 1,000 people is probably not a good idea. Like, I know a lot of people are like, you know, feel the fear in any way, and I do believe that, but I feel like you have to put in work to get to that point.
Yeah.
Like, it's not as simple as just chuck yourself up there and see what happens, because I think it's important to build to that point. And that was what I did personally. I felt like I needed to build to that point that I was then ready, even though, you know, 10 minutes before I was having a meltdown and didn't want to be up there, but I just realized that, you know, I was there and had to do it then.
Yeah.
But I built up to that point.
Yeah. Look, you should build up to anything. I mean, I use the analogy of if you take someone who's never been to the gym before, right, and then you just chuck like, you know, 150 kg on a bar and try to get them to squat it, or chuck 100 kg on a bar and try to get them to bench press it. Like, unless they're, you know, a natural strength freak, then they're just going to get hammered, right? So you need to build.
But people don't want to hear that though.
Yeah.
They want that quick, easy fix. And that's, you know, around sort of food and lifestyle and fitness, that doesn't happen. Like, it takes time to improve the way that you eat or sleep or anything in that area of health. Like, it takes time to.
Yeah. Everything worth doing takes time. Everything worth doing,
100%.
Pretty much, okay. Maybe not, but most, almost everything worth doing, takes time. You know, there's no skill that you're going to just develop just by, you know, clicking your. anytime you do something for the first time, you're probably going to suck. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what it is. You know, the first time I ever tried rapping, you know, I sucked at it. The first time you tried cooking, you probably sucked at it. The first time you tried to make a video or do an Instagram post or do whatever, it's never going to be great, but you've got to, you know, get through that stage of, you know, people fear judgment from others. That's why people are afraid of public speaking. People fear judgment from others. So once you can kind of overcome that hurdle, and if you can do it in one area, then a lot of the value of it, I think, is that it can translate to other areas. So
100%, like that public speaking side has helped my confidence in the stories and Instagram side, and just accepting like who I am and what I'm good at, and just being good at that and not focusing on maybe my weaknesses. I just focus on my strengths and really do them as good as I can. But obviously you just have to learn the process. Like, it's my photo on Instagram look 100 million times better than the first ones I ever took if you scroll right back to the beginning. You know, that's all self-taught, but it's just time, isn't it? Just if you want something bad enough, you'll put in the time to get to that point.
Amen. And that sounds like a strong note to finish this off on. James, thank you so much for joining the podcast. Before we go, let the listeners know where they can find you and follow you online and check out some of your recipes.
So all the recipes are on healthylivingjames.co.uk. That's the blog. Instagram, I'm at healthylivingjames. Facebook, at healthylivingjames. And Twitter, at healthylivingjw. And on Pinterest as well.
Awesome. James,
thanks for having me.
You're welcome, man. Thank you so much for coming on, buddy.
Thank you.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like a bang, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.